Paper 11, right at the beginning. Old single column, page 118. So we're ready to start the third in the triad of Pentateuchs here that they start the revelation off with. You know, they say, okay, we see your Pentateuch, and we'll raise you too. Give you a triune Pentateuch. So this third one, so we did, there's one whole one, that really is obviously directly playing off of the Pentateuch in the Bible. You got, the first five on God the Father, and then the second five fleshing out the rest of existential deity. And now we have five on cosmology. And we start off with the Eternal Isle, because that's obviously the appropriate place to start. If you're going to start on cosmology, you need to start at the center of that cosmology. Literally the center of more than just the cosmology, literally the center of infinity. The center of the totality of reality. About the aisle, everything, is centered. So, just one little thing to add. And remember what you mean by that. Not just material things. We're going to talk about how it's a material aisle, but think in more general terms. It's not just the absolute of matter, which it is, but it's also, in a more generalized sense, the absolute of individuality. There can't be an individuation of anything, thought adjuster or anything, except in relationship to the absolute of individuality, the aisle. Relative to it, all things are individuated. Just, in parallel to the Eternal Son, relative to him as the absolute of unity, all things find a relationship to unity. On the absolute of unity, on the absolute of individuality. So that which starts out totally on the individuality side is moving to find relationship with the unity side, and that which starts out purely on the unity side is moving to find relationship with the individuality side, so that both can have a cosmic character. And so, like we said, that cosmic character, that cosmic domain, that cosmology, the logic of that cosmic domain, that's what we're going to study for the next five papers.
Paper 11, The Eternal Isle of Paradise. Paradise is the eternal center of the universe of universes and the abiding place of the universal Father, the eternal Son, the infinite Spirit, and their divine coordinates and associates. This central isle is the most gigantic organized body of cosmic reality in all the master universe. Paradise is a material sphere as well as a spiritual abode. Of all of the intelligent creation of the Universal Father is domiciled on material abodes. Hence must the absolute controlling center also be material, literal. And again, it should be reiterated that spirit things and spiritual things, beings, are real. The material beauty of paradise consists in the magnificence of its physical perfection. The grandeur of the Isle of God is exhibited in the superb intellectual accomplishments and mind development of its inhabitants. The glory of the central isle is shown forth in the infinite endowment of divine spirit personality, the light of life. But the depths of the spiritual beauty and the wonders of this magnificent ensemble are utterly beyond the comprehension of the finite mind of material creatures. The glory and spiritual splendor of the divine abode are impossible of mortal comprehension. And paradise is from eternity. There are neither records nor traditions respecting the origin of this nuclear isle of light and life.
Okay. just since you kind of were you're pausing on that, in reading it, the spirit things and spiritual beings, made me think, you know, just did you notice that? You know, one says spirit, the other says spiritual. Yeah, just to reflect on why. Yeah, if they just say use spirit for an adjective, they're really pointing you to literally as a substance. You know, there's things made out of that spirit substance, spirit things. You know, the AL is, you know, means it's, you know, you're not using, now you're not using the noun as an adjective. You're actually using the adjective constructed from that. You know, so it means it's of, you know, relating to whatnot, spirit. So, you know, spiritual beings, you know, doesn't mean that they're literally pure spirit, you know, bodies, okay? But they're very, you know, by saying spiritual, you're definitely indicating that, in terms of just an initial basic distinction, you wouldn't, you know, want to think of them as a material being, you know, like an angel. You want to more think of them as a spiritual being, even though they aren't literally pure spirit beings. Can you give me an example of a being that is pure spirit?
Eternal Son.
Eternal Son. How about some lesser ones?
Mm-hmm.
How about all those offspring of the Eternal Son that live on the Son's worlds?
Okay. Not really a person.
All right. You know, they're other than personal, quote unquote. Still, you know, I mean, you have some beings that are, you know, that really in no way that anyone, you know, high or low, can comprehend, has any sort of like innate individuality, you know, in them. So there's an example of a being that has everywhere to go towards a relationship with the absolute of individuality. You know, we're pretty much the opposite.
Would you call that descending order?
Well, I mean, for them, it's ascending too. Yeah. See, yeah, that, and that's, you know, you want to be careful not to you know, see things in that bias of, you know, for, you know, we call a creator son a descending son, but for him is it's an ascent, you know, really.
Yeah.
You know, he reaches the apex when from our lowly perspective we think he reaches the lowest spot. For him it's the highest. You know, he's ascending really. In terms of what he's acquiring, you know, he's not subtracting from his nature. He's adding. He's ascending. Okay, yeah. But in a cosmological, you know, perspective, from the way we can understand the cosmology, he's coming down from the aisle. Okay, yeah. But. Okay, and you know, everyone knows I love to emphasize this. You know, it really is one of the most unprecedented statements in the Revelation. And there just isn't anything remotely in human history like this very revelatory statement. All of the intelligent creation of the universal Father is domiciled on material abodes. I mean, what tradition of thinking beyond, you know, just what goes on in front of us here on this planet, what tradition has a notion that any sort of a quote-unquote spirit being or something, high or low, that every one of them lives on a material sphere? You know, that there isn't some other dimension, some spiritual dimension. There is no such thing. There's just this domain. Every spirit being, no matter how high, including the universal Father at the center of all things, stands on a material surface. Yeah, so, I mean, that is just incredibly unprecedented in terms of altering your perspective on deity, God, spirit being, spirit, to actually come to terms with that when you're looking through a telescope, you're looking to where spirit beings have their abodes. That material telescope looks at the abodes of spirit beings. You don't have to dream up some magical spirit telescope and make a lot of money, selling views through it. Because it's only mystical, the domain of the spirits. No, it's this domain. The angels that are here stand on this planet. They don't float, or have some alternate spirit surface that they stand on this. So that's a really transformative idea. It's the beginnings, it is the beginning of the harmonization of science and religion. That sentence. That's where it all begins. You know that at the highest level, they're one. So science and religion can be harmonized. It's a very, very important statement. I'll never forget the first time I read it. It's just, I just stopped and I'd never even remotely thought something like that. It's like, wait a minute. They're actually saying that angels and stuff live on planets. It never occurred. And it's never occurred to anyone. No one has ever thought to think such a thought. It's really an amazing thing to come to terms with. But again, does it say that they always stand? No, what's the word? Domiciled.
When they're traveling, they're in space. But yeah. Where do they live?
But where's their house? It's not in the spiritual dimension or something, okay? It's on a ball of dirt somewhere, okay? And there's lowly dirt like we have all the way up to the fanciest dirt in the universe, the Isle of Paradise. But it's dirt, okay?
Fancy
dirt. Wait till we read a little bit about this fancy dirt. It's very fancy dirt. It should just completely shatter all of the confused thinking, about the nature of spirit. It should really help to get you, to know that you can say spirit thinks, that spirit is a substance, and there's two substances, and they make contact with each other. So that's the biggie, and it's just, it needs to be noticed. I mean, that's really what the preface is. It's like, the preface of this paper, and then of these five papers, just changes everything. That one sentence just changes everything that humans have ever thought about heaven, or spiritual realms. You haven't really had a personal, notion of God, and a personal place like heaven.
One, the divine residence. Paradise serves many purposes in the administration of the universal realms, but to creature beings, it exists primarily as the dwelling place of deity. The personal presence of the Universal Father is resident at the very center of the upper surface of this well-nigh circular but not spherical abode of the deities. This paradise presence of the Universal Father is immediately surrounded by the personal presence of the Eternal Son, while they are both invested by the unspeakable glory of the Infinite Spirit.
The word invested, like a vest, like clothing, wrapped in, you could translate it that way. And both are completely wrapped you know, around by the unspeakable glory of the infinite Spirit. You know, like we were talking about earlier. I mean, you can literally think of it. You know, the infinite Spirit is the clothes. See, they're invoking that literal image. They are clothed in His glory. He does a lot of things to really kind of evoke, good visualization and word choice that he has, you know, here. Often poetic at times. I was going to mention that, yeah. We've got the third of the three now. So we had a whole bunch of divine counselor, and we got a universal censor. Who can remember what the third of the three are? You know, perfectors of wisdom, right, yeah, yeah. So this is a perfecter of wisdom that wrote this one. I just wanted to pause there. Just you kind of note what word choice he uses. Let it play an image in your mind. As he's going to tell you several times, I mean, there's almost nothing he can really say directly because it's just so totally beyond anything we can comprehend. So he tries to take what little he has and invoke some imagery with it by the use of the language.
Up here, it's it said paradise is a material sphere. Here it says it's not spherical, and in a little bit it says it's flat.
Often you'll use the word sphere in a non-technical sense, just as, world. Now, and of course, very literally, world is going to invoke something kind of spherical too. The idea is that you have a material object. Using the word sphere or world is trying to get you that again. So that you're at least starting with something, some image in your mind that's like the earth that we dwell on, rather again like some mystical fuzzy spirit plane or something,
God dwells, has dwelt, and everlastingly will dwell in this same central and eternal abode. We have always found Him there, and always will. The Universal Father is cosmically focalized, spiritually personalized, and geographically resident at this center of the universe of universes.
Yeah, right there, for the more advanced word noticers in the room, you notice focalized, yeah. It's like, the Father. Remember, just in the previous paper, we got that, those three functional facets of the Trinity, and we were talking about how that's tied to womb, focalizer, upholder, that basic triplet. And so womb, focalizer. Okay, so focalize, that's the second one. You're paralleling infinite capacity, infinite potential, infinite upholder. So one could say, without knowing anything advanced about total deity, and not knowing that the word focalized is kind of a special word, what might I think? It's like, well, first source and center, definitely. When I think of the notion of the centeredness of the first center part of the Father, that certainly seems to match the idea that. That he comes to a focus point here. Okay. And that would be very directly tied to what they're alluding to at a higher level of understanding. Infinite capacity, infinite potential, infinite upholder. That second one, infinite potential. There's a measure of the infinite potential that has to be bottled up to prevent God, the infinite, from being the only fact. It's bottled up in the first center. That that part of the three that gives rise to the word focalize is there in the first center. You don't have all three components. Now, it isn't aren't literally talking about an expression of the mother. We're talking about the father. Yeah. But, you know, in a very direct, total deity details specificity, yeah, there is that very direct relationship to the word focalized there. Okay, but that aside, I mean, obviously that should make immediate, you know, it should be immediately possible to describe the Father as being cosmically focalized because you know he's the first source and center.
Okay. We all know the direct course to pursue to find the universal Father. You are not able to comprehend much about the divine residence because of its remoteness from you and the immensity of the intervening space. But those who are able to comprehend the meaning of these enormous distances know God's location and residence just as certainly and literally as you know the location of New York, London, Rome, or Singapore. Cities definitely and geographically located on your rancho.
Before you read the rest, let me just throw one little thing because it's a long paragraph. Did you notice its remoteness from you and the immensity of the intervening space? It's like, well, aren't they repeating themselves? You know, I mean, think about it. I mean, the word remoteness doesn't have to just be, you know, a literal spatial distance. I mean, how remote are you from the Father in terms of, say, quality? Or absoluteness. Okay. Right. I mean, and that, of course, is the really big thing. I mean, you know, the remoteness in the non-spatial distance sense is the really big divide. I mean, the intervening space is trivial in comparison to the, you know, the separation in every other way. And so that's, yeah, what's going on there. Yeah.
If you were an intelligent navigator equipped with ship, maps, and compass, you could readily find these cities. Likewise, if you had the time and means of passage, were spiritually qualified, and had the necessary guidance, you could be piloted through universe upon universe and from circuit to circuit, ever journeying inward through the starry realms, until at last you would stand before the central shining of the spiritual glory of the universal Father. Provided with all the necessities for the journey, it is just as possible to find the personal presence of God at the center of all things as to find distant cities on your own planet. That you have not visited these places in no way disproves their reality or actual existence. That so few of the universe creatures have found God on paradise in no way disproves either the reality of his existence or the actuality of his spiritual person at the center of all things.
For example, a guy named Lucifer is one of those that had never done that. You know, remember when they say the universe creatures, so few, you know, don't just think mortals. Okay. There's a lot of non-mortal beings. How many times do they say, well, the number of them is quite beyond your numerical concept. And so, okay, you know, there's a lot of beings that have never gone to paradise, never stood in the presence of the Father. Okay. And some very high beings, like a Lemanodec, you know, relative to us, very high, can get in this mode that so many humans are in of, can't see him, doesn't exist. He didn't have, at least immediately, the insight. He was going on just his external sight. Very few beings, like they're saying, have actually used their external sight to see the Father. But we all have been given what we need to, you know, in terms of insight to see. In our case, it's the third cosmic intuition. That's literally the means by which you can see the fact that there's a God. I mean, you aren't literally seeing him standing on the aisle with some magic vision. You're seeing that that isn't just a notion. You're seeing the fact of it with your mind. You know that God is a fact because of that insight, that recognition ability. When you consciousize God because of that intuition, you get a reality response to that consciousization of God. You know, putting your mind in a form that you would call God gets a reality response. Yep, that's not your imagination. That's a fact. Okay. Lucifer had the two, but he forgot. And he started relying too much on his external sight.
This is a new idea to me, that beings can be living in the universe but not be basically on the path of journeying inward. Do you mean they just sort of get busy doing other stuff and they forget the overall goal?
There is just countless beings who are not ascending. They're just stationary orders. And then on top of that, there's countless beings that have nothing whatsoever to do with ascending, this whole ascending scheme. I mean, you know, just the ascension scheme is only one of seven. Yeah, so uncountable numbers of beings, like they're saying, have never been to paradise. Blessed are those who believe and yet have not seen. Most of the universe has to just know that with their insight. Their personal recognition that's within them. Yes, there is a God, though I have never seen him.
Do we know what the other six schemes are?
No. They're only, you know, this is only about revealing the ascension scheme. The other six, they weren't allowed to really say much of anything about them.
John.
Oh, you have some?
Any thoughts why they picked out those four cities, or they just...
I heard you chuckle, and I knew you were thinking that. So why did they pick Singapore?
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I didn't know Singapore was that big of a city. But, you know, it is now.
But in that mode, notice what's right before that. I wanted to bring this out. You know, and that whole bit about the remoteness. In that preview, in the second paragraph of the section, it says, God dwells, has dwelt, and everlastingly will dwell in this same central and eternal abode. It doesn't say at. Notice it says in. Because in a very technical sense, right, and if you try to do literally the trip to Singapore analogy to get to the aisle, you know, you set your sails and you go flying across space. You get to the geometric center of this big symmetric structure, and there's nothing there. Yeah. The aisle isn't at the center of the space that you would be journeying through. One way to think about what you are doing is, you know, you're going across, and then you have to go in when you're there. Now, of course, what you're really doing is the whole ascension scheme. You're not only going across, but you're ever, you know, more penetrating in, you know, especially once you get to Havona. You're spiraling in to that center point. You're going deeper and deeper into the, you know, into the core of reality. It's at a center that you have to, you know, you can literally think of universe as spherical, and you've got to penetrate through a whole bunch of core and mantle, and whatnot to get actually down to where it is in the center. You can travel all over the surface and you won't find it. On the plane that we could imagine taking the Starship Enterprise on, you know, you wouldn't find that whole central domain.
So this is not a house with a view, in other words.
But when you're there, you know, you look out and you can see everything. See, from there you can see everything. From here you can see almost nothing.
It's the highest point. You'll see everything from there.
Yeah, it's the highest point. You'll see everything from there. Yeah, see, so there's just so many things. You know, it's, you know, think about like that little reversal thought experiment. You know, how many times do they tell you that there's a being that can see you as you are, and you can't see them at all? It's like, well, that can't be real. That's got to be magical. If they can see me, I can see them. No. you have very, very narrow vision. They see you in a deeper way than you can see yourself. That's why they can see you. You can't see deep enough to see them. You see right over the top of them. You're looking right over the top of them. Okay. So, yeah, just notice little things like that. You know, the very fact that he uses in is tied to that something besides the intervening space. There's this remoteness thing. Yeah, you've got to somehow go deep in to reality to actually be standing there. And we're not even remotely deep. We're the shallowest of shallow things that exist. Yeah. You know, if you reread that, you'll see little things, you know, that are tied to that too. I mean, you know, you notice that they threw in one of the ifs was if you were spiritually qualified. You know, okay, that's an in, not on a cross. So it's all over. And just, you know, keep that, I wanted to really stress that, because really keep that in mind. As you start to go forward, and he's now is going to, you know, try to explain things a little bit. Remember how much he must be compromising. How dim a shadowy projection he must be painting. Everything he says, you're going to have to try to not think of it simplistically. You know, it's going to be a suggestion to try to give you some sense. If you think about it in simple, simplistic traveling to Singapore, well, you're going to totally misunderstand everything about it. All right.
The Father is always to be found at this central location. Did he move, universal pandemonium would be precipitated. For there converge in him at this residential center the universal lines of gravity from the ends of creation. Whether we trace the personality circuit back through the universes or follow the ascending personalities as they journey inward to the Father, whether we trace the lines of material gravity to nether paradise or follow the insurging cycles of cosmic force, whether we trace the lines of spiritual gravity to the eternal sun or follow the inward processional of the paradise sons of God, whether we trace out the mind circuits or follow the trillions upon trillions of celestial beings who spring from the infinite spirit, by any of these observations or by all of them, we are led directly back to the Father's presence, to his central abode. Here is God personally, literally, and actually present. And from his infinite being, there flow the flood streams of life, energy, and personality to all universes.
Okay, the first thing is pretty fun. Okay, so now, if he did move, universal pandemonium would be precipitated. Fun choice of words. If there's any literary aware in the room. So if you read Milton's Paradise Lost, the capital of hell is pandemonium, capital P. Okay, you see, it literally means all demon abode. Yeah. So you just look there, D-E-M-O-N, okay, and pan, wow. You know, okay. It's the demon of, it's the abode of all demons, wow. You know, is what it means. It's the abode of all demons. It's wow. The capital of hell. Okay, so in other words, did he move, all hell would break loose. He literally says that. You're not, you know, vamping. I mean, he literally says that. Okay, that's literally what he's saying. For him to choose to say it that way. It's pretty fun. Now, you know, why would he do that? I mean, if you, you know, if you look in other places in the book, if they use pandemonium, it's in, you know, relationship to the default or the rebellion. Okay, obvious times you might use that word. Okay, what is the Isle of Paradise? It is the capital of, I mean, you could just take it all the way. It's the capital of the cosmos infinite. It is the capital. Okay. And from that capital, you have this, all of this connectivity that reaches out. Okay. I mean, so he wants you to literally have that image invoked where the capital, it would still be a capital, but not a capital of the harmony of the cosmos infinite anymore, a harmony established by all these circuits that we just read. It would be the capital of hell, okay? There would be nothing but chaos. Every minute shred of order, everywhere in everything, every being, everything would disappear. All would be the Greek starting point. In the beginning, there was nothing but chaos. Every measure of stability in an object around you, every measure of sanity you might fleetingly try to hold on to in your mind, every measure of any stability, uniformity, everything is there because he's there. Yeah, as the first source and center of all things and beings. Yeah. And you would have the capital of chaos if it weren't for that absolute of absolutes there anchoring everything.
Well, I'm just trying to... he's at the center of everything. So if he moved... he would have to move in relationship to something.
Yeah, and what is that?
Paradise.
Yeah. I mean, that's, remember, where is he located? Not close to the center point.
Yeah.
Okay, right smack at the center. If he moves 1 nanometer off the center of the aisle, I mean, the aisle is a little bit different than the sphere we're standing on. I can move around and everything is okay. Okay, the aisle is part of the anchoring system. He has to be perfectly aligned with that. I mean, it is. Remember, it's the absolute of individuality. He has to be absolutely centered on its center point in order for his stabilizing influence to reach every point in the cosmos infinite, because he's the individuality of the parts. The Father is the individuality of the parts. Any part in the cosmos has stability, like an automaton is ongoing. Right, but if you think in a sort of a sequential sense, right, as the universal creator, I guess you would say, you know, he gives rise to the Isle and Havona, and, you know, but in an eternal sense, they just are,
yeah.
Okay, and it really isn't so much causal, and that's kind of what you're getting at here is. It's an indispensable part of what he has to be. You know, it's his hand. If he cuts off his hand, he can't hold the cosmos and everything falls. You know, and literally cutting off his hand would be to move the slightest bit off the center point.
Is that what makes it the standard level is that center point?
Yeah, because
otherwise it seems like there's all kinds of motion happening, coming and going, mm-hmm. But the static, I finally get it, it's that center where it can't move even a tiny bit.
Right.
Yeah.
So That's what it means to be the absolute of individuality. See, it has to be absolutely static. I mean, I can't be sane if the aisle isn't absolutely static. It's there's no way that I could possibly have a constancy of sanity. Or anything else you can think of like that. There has to be an absolutely static fact that we can all be in reference to. Okay, there's a whole bunch of questions.
He chose to be there and to not move. I think that was a huge, huge gift to his children.
Does he need to move? He touches everything from there intimately. There's no motivation to move. So I'd like to move closer to that automaton. Okay, I'm at the center of it already. I can't move closer. I mean, there's no way he can't move in any direction and get closer to anything. He's the individuality of the parts. He's at the center of every single part in the cosmos already.
This distinction is vital. Repeat that again in relation to this.
Right. See, so, I mean, so he's the individuality of the parts and she's the individuality of the whole.
The individual members are not connected to each other.
Right.
Except in relation.
Right. See, so he creates, I mean, every part is intimate with him, but not with each other. Because we're talking absoluteness here. The relationship is absolute, not relative. So for him to be absolutely connected to each part, the corollary of that, the consequence of that, is every part is absolutely separated. So there has to be something that connects the parts together. Yeah, the mother.
So I picture it, his feet are what are unmoving, if you want to be anthropomorphic.
Sure, yeah. What are his feet? You can point to them on this chart. You've got six different things. Is it that, or that? Okay? I mean, what part of the Father is directly connected to the aisle? Universal controller. Right? Those are literally his feet. Okay? And you think about hands that create, okay, you could, if you want to go anthropomorphic on, okay, maybe the universal creator could be his hands, and, et cetera. You could play with an anthropomorphic, association like that.
It's interesting, you got the feet right at the bottom of the chart.
Yeah.
And the opposite.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of some of these things. I mean, it's like, wow, coincidentally, it's there. So many things are just kind of there to be a means of understanding. And like I try to point out, that's why it's important to lay out perspectives like this, so that some things you can understand because it's just right there, literally in the picture. Not everything is there, but some things aren't sort of alluded to at all. I mean, they're just directly there, and so you can understand them. It's like, wow, like you just said, isn't that convenient, quote unquote, that it's at the bottom of the chart, right, where you'd expect to find feet, where you'd expect to find creature-identified deity, where you'd expect to find a point that reaches down and touches those of us who are at the bottom, who are in the dirt. He grabs us with his toes first, okay, and he holds us with his toes. Like we've done this before. He grabs a hold of each automaton, in us from the center of the automaton, not from outside. He's from the inside, through the aisle and into the automaton. He grabs it, knows its location. He can find you that way to encircuit you in the personality circuit. That's the beauty. Like it's like, wow, I'm feeling like I'm understanding this. When you get, that's why you want to create these analogies, these perspectives, these very direct, picturizations. Notice at the very end of that paragraph, instead of just letting those words blow by, if you're trying to see if you can understand things a little bit deeper, see if you can ask why, or answer, you can definitely ask why, see if you can answer the question of why. It says, flood streams of life, energy, and personality. Why not a whole bunch of other words? Why those three words? Okay. It's got to be tied to a facet. Okay, well, personality, I mean, that's the Universal Father. Okay, and, you know, along with the first source. Energy, we were just talking about that, universal controller. The life part, okay. You know that the reservoir of life animation is the infinite. When you think about it from a reservoir perspective. Okay. What part of the Father directly contacts that reservoir? Lastly, the infinite upholder, yes. Right. That's the facet that's in direct contact. And you know life is coming down through the mother. Part of the mother is the downstepped expressions of the infinite upholder. See, that's how that can work. You've got to have something that's directly in contact with the infinite. The infinite upholder is. So when you downstep that, you bring life down through the mother. Just start challenging yourself, you know, when you see things like that. It's like, I'll bet you that's not just a random choice of words. I wonder if I can understand why those words are there. Yeah. See if you can use your growing knowledge of the nature of the Father, what facets are involved in the Father. All right. I think that ought to do it for the moment. And you want to read some more? Okay.
Two, right. Nature of the Eternal Isle. Since you are beginning to glimpse the enormousness of the material universe discernible even from your astronomical location, your space position in the starry systems, it should become evident to you that such a tremendous material universe must have an adequate and worthy capital, a headquarters commensurate with the dignity and infinitude of the universal ruler of all this vast and far-flung creation of material realms and living beings.
There's capital, see? So it's, you know, there you can put the two directly together. It literally is appropriate to call it a capital, he just did. If it wasn't appropriate, he wouldn't have said it. Okay. Therefore, yeah. What would be the anti-capital? It would be pandemonium. The capital of hell. Okay.
In form, paradise differs from the inhabited space bodies. It is not spherical. It is definitely ellipsoid, being 1/6 longer in the north-south diameter than in the east-west diameter. The central isle is essentially flat, and the distance from the upper surface to the nether surface is 1/10 that of the east-west diameter. These differences in dimensions taken in connection with its stationary status and the greater outpressure of force energy at the north end of the isle make it possible to establish absolute direction in the master universe.
Okay. Now, why do you care about that? What relevancy does that have to your day-to-day life? Okay. It's the Isle of Paradise, so it's probably going to be some big picture stuff that you take for granted. Okay. If the isle literally was perfectly spherical, there wouldn't be three dimensions of the absentite, which means there wouldn't be three dimensions of the finite. Okay. Because you break that spherical symmetry fully, it has a distinct dimension this way, and this way. No two are the same. That's what gives rise to three dimensions. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the isle is the pattern of infinity. Okay. That's a pretty basic pattern. Is that you have three dimensionality. Okay. And
the proportions between those.
Well, that gets into...
Now,
higher details, which we can't answer yet. And let me just say that right now, since you brought that up. Now that we're getting into cosmology, there are going to be a number of things that are still deeply mysterious. There's a lot of unpacking yet to be done about the nature of physical reality. But you know that deep down in the nature of physics, in the nature of the three dimensions of the absonite, and how that gives rise to a finite expression that we experience, you know, of atoms and whatnot, this is very important, that it's not one-fifth bigger, but one-sixth bigger. Yeah, why? I certainly don't know. Okay? But you know it does. You know nothing is arbitrary. Okay? And you know we're talking about some of the very most fundamental impressions that the aisle makes on physical reality. Okay? All right? So, a lot of the little details, like 1/6 and stuff, we can't unpack that at this point. But the bigger picture, you know, if you have an eye for natural philosophy and not just physics, if you know that if there is a physics, there's a logic that underlies it, you might actually want to get a doctor in the philosophy of that to understand, why is there three dimensions? That's the kind of questions that a natural philosopher asks, not a physicist, per se. Why is there space? Why is there time, etc.? Now, okay, here they're telling you. It's why there's three dimensions. Anything beyond, it's like, why not? I can't answer anything beyond that. But, the aisle is, remember, it's an existential fact. So, they reveal what the nature of the aisle. They reveal, the nature of what it is. And then, so that's your initial assumption. To try to somehow go behind that, it's too much to ask. But that's a reasonable. I can start with the absolute as an initial assumption. Now I know why there's three dimensions, because of its nature. And notice, so one of the things that you have here is it's establishing the basic nature of the place, a three-dimensional place. It is possible to establish absolute direction in the master universe, is the last thing you just read. That comes in too, because you don't have, for instance, no difference between the upper surface and the lower surface. One is spiritual, one's not. There's a differential across that dimension, so there's a direction to it. Okay, and then they told you there's a differential across the north-south dimension too. So if I want to locate a star in the night sky on the celestial sphere, okay, I've got to give two coordinates, a declination and a right ascension, an altitude angle and an azimuth angle, okay, a vertical angle and a horizontal angle. Okay. In order to give two angles, I have to have an origin for those two angles. Okay? See, I've got two, differentiations where there's a difference between up and down and there's a difference between north and south. So, I could take an angle, down from that up direction, say, or I could take an angle up from the plane, and it's going up towards the up direction or down towards the down direction. You can define that angle, and the same way here with the azimuth angle. I can go, this way from the north direction, okay? So you can see, that's what they're saying. You can, because of that differential in those two, you can specify a direction. And notice the way they word it. It is possible to establish absolute direction in the master universe, not, you know, from the aisle, but every point in the master universe. Because remember, this, the fact of the aisle and its nature, the nature of the eternal aisle, that nature enters the master universe at every single point. It imposes that pattern on the nature of a point and all the physics that's about that point. Okay? So what they're saying is, if you can penetrate down to the depths of physics, you'll see that you can orient yourself. There is a directionality, and that's very curious. I certainly can't unpack that either. Somewhere down in the depths of physics, there's going to be an aha. Okay? We just found that there's a difference between this direction and this direction. And see, and it's just a, and just to make sure that you don't just think, oh yeah, it makes this big level structure that's elliptical. And all. No, it's at the point too. Not only the whole, but the point, every point, has this pattern in it. So collections of automatons are being influenced by this in some way, yeah, that I certainly have not unpacked yet.
It's fundamental.
Yeah. Yeah. And wouldn't it be fun to figure it out? Yeah. So just let that really kind of sink in, you know, this, you know. Why is the aisle important? You know, how is it not? I mean, it's just, okay, it's the center of infinity, the pattern of infinity. Yeah.
Those individual particles, you would have to be speaking about the subatomic or subelectronic level.
Well, and this is nothing simplistic. I mean, literally, an automaton in terms of its finite space presence is spherical.
Right.
It's not ellipsoidal.
Right.
Okay. They tell you point blank it's a sphere with a certain radius. Okay. Okay, so this is nothing trivial. It's not like it makes automatons shaped like pancakes, elliptical pancakes. Okay. Nothing is trivial like that. Okay. That's what I'm saying. I mean, you can only go wrong if you think simplistically like that. Nothing about what the aisle is doing is simplistic like that. Okay. And what, you know, what, so Crystal, what is it? Well, yeah, that's the question. Okay, you know, if I could unpack all of the physics, how far down the road would we be? Okay, this is this huge reservoir of unpacked knowledge here that would transform everything if you could unpack some of this stuff. Okay,
it's all in storage.
Right. But the clues that we need, you know, are in here.
Does the direction of our compass have anything to do with
it? But the fact that we have compasses has something to do with it. Why did we feel a need to invent a compass? Why do we want to know what direction we're going? That has everything to do with this. The fact that humans would be interested in direction comes from the fact that directionization is at the most fundamental level of reality. You inexorably will have the notion of direction in your mind. If there wasn't these differentials, the word wouldn't even be in the dictionary. Okay. it's the origin of directionality, you know, and in a vague little dim sense, humans decided they wanted to go exploring, and they didn't just want to go randomly. They wanted to know where they were going. They wanted to be able to go in a certain direction, etc. You know, they wanted to know direction. And so, you know, they used the stars, and then they figured out it was, you know, they could use the magnetic field of the Earth, you know, and use a compass. And
in just three short generations, the roaming space of a child in a normal,
mm-hmm,
living situation has shrunk down to the point that most children are now not allowed to leave their yards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the universe is mind-made and personality-managed. You can't just let the universe try to manage itself. It has immediate consequences for a child not being able to roam without being in danger. It means that most likely you can't let your cat out of the house because he'll get eaten by a fox or a mountain lion or something. Okay? We used to be able to let our cats out of the house. Now, more and more, we can't let our cats out of the house. Because, well, you don't have to manage nature. Nature is innately divine. Matter of fact, anything that's wrong with it is because you tried to do something. If you would just set it free and let it... No. Everything has to be managed. Nothing is self-managing. And if the extent to which you don't manage it, there will begin to be negative consequences on civilization until finally civilization is impossible. Civilization is only possible to the extent to which you can manage nature. Again, it's these sophistries that we've begun to let dominate our consciousness. God made us to manage things. We need to have the courage to take that on. Okay, so that's the kind of stuff that you want to look for when you're going through the physics papers in the book initially. Don't try to figure out some detailed, thing of physics. Look for the natural philosophy first. Try to see that what it's trying to tell you about the logic of the cosmos first. Details can come later. If you don't have the logic, any details you attempt will be guaranteed to be misunderstandings. There's no way for you to have a proper relationship to the details if you have a false relationship to the big picture. That's why almost everything in current science is false. Because they said there is no big picture. And so they've stopped looking for it. Okay. all right. So, even if you don't have a lot of experience in the details of science, you have encirclement in the Holy Spirit. You have a gift from the Creative Mother Spirit that allows you, if you take delight in cultivating, to have a logical recognition and be able to see some of these basic things that will help you to be oriented in the cosmos. If people who don't have a connection to the cosmos don't invent compasses because they have no notion that their life should have direction. Okay, look who on the planet invented the compass. It's not someone with a bone through their nose. Okay? Okay? You have to be going beyond Sangik to have enough connection to the cosmos where you begin to desire to synchronize with the with directionality. And the invention of the compass or things like that, sextants, it's just the beginning expressions in mankind of an eternal quest. From here to eternity, you're going to be in quest of greater and greater synchronization with the directionality of the cosmos. It begins in very simple fashion, wanting to know where the North Star is, and which side of the ship is in starboard.
Which direction is progress?
Right. Yeah. If you just have the notion of progress, but you have no sense of direction, it's a zero probability you'll go up. Because there's only one up direction. Everything else. Okay. And you know, because we're not innately made an uppist, we're made a blob of matter. We don't have a lot of spirit gravity that would give us an immediate relationship to up. We mostly have material gravity sense within. So, it's really, forget about the rest of the you know, of the sphere, there's really only two things that ever happen. Straight up or straight down. And, you know, and if you just let your inner magnetic field of yourself orient your inner compass, it has all, material gravity orients that. It swings the needle down, okay? You will go down in the name of progress. 100% guaranteed, okay? It's impossible for you to not go down in the name of progress if you haven't taken delight in cultivating. That's the problem with getting the notion of the word progress in your head. It's like, ooh, yeah, let's do that. Let's make it a religion, even. Let's make it an ism. Let's put a lot of zeal into making ourselves go down really, really fast in the name of progress.
Yeah, full throttle down.
Full throttle down. Okay, okay. So is this important? Is this relevant that the aisle establishes directionality? Yeah, it's all important.
We have a mind of gravity. You didn't say that.
Mm-hmm. So but not if it's sad, not if it's sad to record. You don't. Remember when we were reading about that? That requires you to have significant stuff up in the personal domain to be feeling that mindful gravity. It's just like spiritual gravity. See, I mean, unless you've taken delight in cultivating, all you're going to feel down in the lower part of the hourglass is material gravity. Okay, you're not going to feel mindful or spiritual gravity.
You know?
And you'll get this. It's like, you know, I think that, you know, the truth of it all is that you need to have your feet stuck really solidly in the mud, you know. Yeah. And you exalt the mudness into an ism. All right.
The central aisle is geographically divided into three domains of activity. One, upper paradise. Two, peripheral paradise. And three, nether paradise. We speak of that surface of paradise which is occupied with personality activities as the upper side, and the opposite surface as the nether side. The periphery of paradise provides for activities that are not strictly personal or non-personal. The Trinity seems to dominate the personal or upper plane, the unqualified absolute, the nether or impersonal plane. We hardly conceive of the unqualified absolute as a person, but we do think of the functional space presence of this absolute as focalized on nether paradise.
Okay, well, we'll get to the groovy stuff there at the end first. But okay. Notice how that sentence, the first sentence of that paragraph started out. We speak of. Okay, why did the Perfecter of Wisdom, you know, put those words at the beginning of the sentence? Why didn't he just say, you know, the surface which is occupied with personality activities is the upper side? Okay. Who is he speaking to most likely, if you found this book? Someone who really doesn't care much about spirit and has no favoritism that way, no bias that way. You know, he knows who he's speaking to. Okay, you know. Caution, caution, caution. Don't go, it's exactly like I always thought. That matter stuff is irrelevant. It's the Netherlands, okay? I should interpret everything in the Urantia book as being a validation that spirit is higher than matter. See? You know. But there's an obvious reason for calling them upper and nether, because who is going to be thinking about paradise? Automatons? No, beings. Things are not thinking about the aisle. Beings are thinking about the aisle. You know, and if I'm thinking about the aisle, I'm thinking about standing on the aisle, you know, I want to stand on the aisle, not, you know, dangle from the aisle. Okay, I mean, all right? Unless I have a prehensile tail, okay? Right. I mean, it's just a logical picture, okay, to make the upper surface, okay. But it does not mean, you know, that matter is nothing, spirit is everything, you know, that sort of stuff. Yeah, and there definitely have been those who have interpreted the revelation in those horrendously false terms, you know, because they were totally biased to their spiritual consciousness. They didn't have the other eye open. They had no cosmic three-dimensional perspective when they're interpreting the Urantia book, so everything they say is false. Okay. You've got to catch yourself wanting to look for affirmation of spirit first-ism. Okay, so you've got that basic issue, and then look at the technical stuff he throws in at the end there. Okay. The first thing I want you to notice there is he's begging you to not interpret this simplistically with the seven absolutes of infinity. I mean, of all the three absolutes, I mean, no matter how much you favor, well, maybe even, you know, the more you favor your spiritual consciousness, you're not going to be inclined to think of the unqualified absolute like you might be inclined to think of the deity absolute. You know, look at the word he says. But we do think of the functional space presence of this absolute as focalized on Nether Paradise. Facets of deity function, not reservoirs. Okay, so what is he really saying there for those of you who have begun to think about paper 105? If you flip the unqualified absolute around from the individuality viewpoint, where it's a reservoir, see it from a unity viewpoint, it's a facet of deity called the infinite capacity. The functioning of the infinite capacity. Okay? So,
that's how it extends itself.
Right. I am that which extends, yes. Exactly. Without trying to understand everything that this implies, what I'm about to say, just reflect on, or begin a journey of reflection with this thought. Lastly, the infinite upholder. Okay. In that lastly mode, the infinite upholder is extending out to fill the infinite capacity. As the infinite upholder extends out to the limits of the infinite capacity, there's a reciprocal thing in play. The unqualified absolute is focalizing on the center of Nether Paradise. That you have that. Just think of you have this reciprocal action as you know. I mean, if you just let yourself just initially take a very simplistic kind of direct view. Infinite capacity sounds like a great big volume. Okay, so I'm gonna be going outward, you know, spherically outward to the limits of the infinite capacity. What would be the reciprocal of that motion? It would be something that would be focalizing towards the center point. So what the infinite upholder is moving towards, if you flip that around to the individuality viewpoint, the unqualified absolute is focalizing in on the aisle. See, the Father starts as the first source and sent literally the center, like you mentioned, focalized. Remember, we had focalized one other time so far. You got the center, and lastly, the infinite upholder. See, so if one is going from the center point out to the margins, the reciprocal expression is going from the outermost margins into the center. Okay. That's why the unqualified absolute is focalized in the center of Nether Paradise. Because that, you know, that whole bit about when you start thinking about the picture, you think about the space potency, the presence of the unqualified absolute in the master universe, and you think about actualizing that potential, it's most actualized close in, and the farther you go out, it's less and less actualized until, you know, you finally get to the point where it's not actualized at all. You have nothing but the space potency. Okay. So it has, you know, so it's just see the reciprocal picture here of the Father extending out, which means there's a reciprocal expression from the individuality viewpoint of a focalization coming in the center of the aisle. That's what's between the lines of that.
That's the function of the unqualified absolute.
I am that which extends. So then the reciprocal of that is going to be focalized, see? When you look at the reciprocal of the infinite capacity, the unqualified absolute, it's going to be focalized because of that extending action.
It has to be extending from something, from some
point. Yeah, and as soon as you think that, see, you're in the individuality viewpoint, see? Right. That's the thing. And so what you're going to see is a focalization of the unqualified at another paradise. And, yeah, you're right. It's fun to just... So, you know, they mentioned the Trinity and the unqualified absolute, or the infinite capacity. Okay, here's the infinite capacity in the seventh functional level. Here's the Paradise Trinity in the first functional level. So, look, you know, this paragraph juxtaposes those two. It says on one side, it's the Trinity, on the other side, it's the functioning, it's the infinite capacity. Yeah, like that line there. On one side, it's the Paradise Trinity. On the other side of the line, it's the infinite capacity. That's how that's actually right on this chart. That those two are on two sides of a line, a dividing line. You know? So you could almost kind of think of the Isle of Paradise as like this, and the upper surface is here, and the nether surface is there. You know, after all, the Paradise Isle is right there.
Pretty handy.
Okay. I mean, you know, it's not too much of a stretch to just kind of see that right there. That's like, well, that doesn't seem to be in defiance of the picture here. Yeah, it seems to be relatively conformal with it. It just seems to, I seem to be able to kind of put that in there in a sensical way. Okay. So again, that says pointing out that they're thinking about some of the relationships that are expressed in this chart when they say something like that. You know, what picturization of everything do I have where I can somehow see the Trinity on one side of a line and the unqualified absolute on the other side of the line? I mean, can you think of anything that anyone has ever produced in seven absolutes infinity that would have such a dividing line? No. Yeah, but it's right here. You can see it right there. So, now, it's this line. This started with, at the beginning of the foreword, we had a column of seven levels. And we wrapped it around into the ellipse here. And we said that, see, it's at this line that there are fundamental linkers, linking facts that tie the seventh and the first level together. Huh. We just seem to have a statement here about the aisle is part of that linking the two together. The two sides of the aisle are actually on each side of the link. Okay, now if I wrap that around and connect it together, there must be incredible tension wanting to tear that apart. Well, if I anchored the two sides in the aisle, and the aisle is made out of a substance that has infinite tensile strength, will this stay glued together? Yeah, that'll stay glued together really well. That's the glue that binds, but that's some kind of super glue.
Absolute matter.
Absolutum. Yeah. It's glued together with absolutum. It absolutely won't come apart. See how...
Nothing less would do.
See how this stuff works? I mean, the picture, the images work. You could see them in the book all over the place once you start looking for them.
The Trinity seems to dominate the personal or upper plane. Well, the Trinity is non-personalizable.
Yeah.
But if you didn't have the non-personal, the non-personal in some way that I don't understand has to be there to make the personal possible.
Remember, that's one of the things that the universal censor was trying to bring out when he was talking about the Trinity. It's like, if you really want to understand this, you know, what allows the three infinite persons to be separated? The Trinity does. The Trinity is what, you know, holds on to the undivided so that they can be divided. Just like you're saying. See, you can make this makes sense. You know, this can be talked about. This can be understood. You're on track with your picture.
The 3, 4, 5, and 6 functional levels of associative, creative, evolutional, and supreme are below this horizon line. What is this horizon line?
Does it mean anything?
Yeah, no, it does mean. I mean, and you know, of course, you want to really make it a horizon line. Put the chart upside down. So, you know, you're in the fifth functional level, you're standing here and you're looking to the horizons, you know, you can only see in a direct, with your direct conceptual eye, you can only see to those horizon lines. To recognize anything beyond those horizon lines, you need insight. Okay, you have to see beyond the horizontal, to see into the rest of the picture. You need insight. The revelators reveal this part of the picture, and your insight gives you a reality response that what they've revealed, you know, is indeed there. You know, like we were just having a recognition back there about how logical the static level is once it kind of finally sinks into your head. I mean, see, it's been revealed to you, and initially it's like, I don't see that. You can't. It's below the horizon line. Look deeper. Use your insight. That your insight will give you a reality response, that there is a static level. Yeah. So that's, see, how far can you, how much of the Father can you directly see conceptually to the anchor of the personality circuit, to the universal Father. The first source and center is below the horizon line.
The universal creator is not below the horizon. Mm. But the conviction that everything has to have a source is above the horizon line.
Yeah. See, this, you know, a first source and center, your logical acumen tells you they must exist. You know, your insight tells you, you know, because you know the universe is logical. Even if you can't see it, you know they have to be there. There has to be a first source and center in order for anything to be logical. You know, and if you look in historical records, you won't see people really talking about that because it's sad to record. But you will hear people talking about a father and a creator and a controller. I mean, read about those notions, you know, attempts to talk about those notions in the Bible. Or upholders. I mean, you can see those directly. So people have talked about fathers and creators and controllers and upholders. But this stuff, okay, it requires insight to have any notion that they're there. Yep.
Have the insight without the revelation, right? We believe the revelation, so that's right.
Yeah, it's very important. That's why I said it the way I said it. I mean, don't think of your three cosmic intuitions as some magical things. I mean, they're reality responses. They allow, if the revelators can put something in front of you, you don't have mode of consciousness, so you don't have a consciousness that can put something in front of you. So it has to be put in front of you via revelation. But once it is put in front of you, you can recognize it as valid, you know. You get a reality response off of it. You couldn't do that if you didn't have the Holy Spirit. They could blather on in revelations all they want, and nothing would happen inside of us. If we had no reality response, it would just be blah 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 to our subjective minds. Okay, and that's why so many people read the book and they go, it's just blah, 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 blah. It's because they have no objective consciousness. They've just labeled themselves as, not human in their consciousness. Okay, that's, I mean, only, I mean, if you can't see it for what it is, you're not functioning at a human level of consciousness. You're a fancy animal. It's as simple as that. It's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch. I mean, you have to have taken a delight in cultivating enough recognition to recognize it for what it is. If you haven't, there's nothing they can say to make it, manifest to you. You have to see it. Okay. A thing related to that is, you know, that difference between knowledge and truth. Knowledge is knowingness that can be given, the ledge part, you know, can be given. Truth is a know, you know, I can have a knowingness of truth, but it's not knowledge. I can't give that to you. You have to see truth. Well, you by yourself. I can attempt, like the revelators do, to try to foster you to look in the right direction, but I can't literally turn your head and open your eyes. You have to do that. I can't give you that part, and the revelators can't give you that part. So,
God has to do that within us, really.
And see that, right. I mean, the Spirit of Truth is there to really help you. So post Pentecost. You now have a reality response that's directly tied to truth. You know, the three cosmic intuitions, none of them are directly a truth recognition. Spirit of Truth is a fourth intuition, a fourth reality response that is directly tied to the fact of truth. Okay? So, you know, it means that you can get out of the Pontius Pilate mode of quid est veritas. I mean, if you have a relationship to the Spirit of Truth, you know what truth is. You've seen it. It's not some abstract, you know, what is truth? If you've seen it, you don't. No one needs to explain to you. If you haven't seen it, no one can. But if you do turn in the direction of truth, because you have the Spirit of Truth now, you can get a really firm, you know, you don't have to sort of, it's like, well, all in the bigger picture, I think I feel something tangible there. You don't have to get at it indirectly through the Holy Spirit. You have this direct reality response tied to it. So it'll feel really solid. Yeah, okay.
Just dawned on me, that's why people, you talk to them, they're looking for that response. They haven't found it in the spirit realm, so they turn away from the spirit realm. They look for it in matter.
Mm-hmm. That so few of the universe creatures have found God on paradise in no way disproves either the reality of his existence or the actuality of his spiritual person at the center of all things. Okay. That's why they've got that there, because there's so many people. Yep.
Yeah, and I know you once called it the air detector. A lot of people turn their spiritual
consciousness
into an air and evil detector or a BS.
Well, not so much a BS detector, but an error and evil detector.
Well, some people turn it into a BS detector.
Well, that's your first cosmic intuition. So you see that whole bit about the unqualified absolute there is actually, just notice the things that are challenging you to not think of it simplistically. Reservoirs of potential don't function. The word is function. So it's just a simple one word. All it takes is one word to challenge you to seek a higher point of view to understand the paragraph.
The eternal isle is composed of a single form of materialization, stationary systems of reality. This literal substance of paradise is a homogeneous organization of space potency, not to be found elsewhere in all the wide universe of universes. It has received many names in different universes, and the Melchizedeks of Nebadon long since named it Absolutum. This paradise source material is neither dead nor alive. It is the original non-spiritual expression of the first source and center. It is paradise. And paradise is without duplicate.
Okay. So the Melchizedeks of Nebadon long since named it absolutum. So the Melchizedek universities are taught in Latin, apparently. That would be a simple-minded interpretation, right? Okay.
You've obviously heard these.
Okay. Right. So what do they actually say? I mean, you know, that's a Latin word. Absolutus, absoluta, absolutum, okay? Masculine, feminine, neuter. The Isle of Paradise is the absolute of matter. Okay, that's just a basic philosophical statement about what it is. So in other words, the Melchizedeks just fall back on that simple fact. It's the absolute of matter. It's made out of absolute of matterness, i.e. in Latin, absolutum. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's the way you properly interpret a statement like that. It's not like there's some whiteboard on Salvington that's got A, B, S, O, L. You know, I mean, they're not writing in, you know, Latin letters. And, so you get the point. I mean, it's a little bit, you know, goofy, but that's a very, you know, the philosophical point there, I hope, sinks in. I mean, about how to read this book. Can't be simple-minded when you read it. You know, you understand the truth of what they're saying. So this paradise source material is neither dead nor alive. And up in paper 42, they just say, oh, phooey with it. Let's just call it living, non-spiritual substance. Okay, why? You know, why do you have this conundrum here of language? Okay, remember what we're talking about with this absolutum. No matter how high the being is, how high the sub-absolute being is, including a perfecter of wisdom, they're standing on the aisle, they're looking at the body of the eternal sun, they're looking at the substance of the aisle, and there's not one shred of difference that meets the eye. You cannot see any difference. Okay? If you're looking at a pure spirit body of the eternal sun, spirit is self-animating substance. The life, you know, the living vitality is innate in spirit matter. Okay, so if they're looking at the two and there's no difference, okay, when you look at the aisle, you see something that looks just like the purest self-animating substance that you can see. So even though, you know, logically you know it's non-spiritual substance, it's not innately self-animating, to the eye it is nothing but exactly like the purest of self-animating things that you can look at. So what else, you know, when all is said and done, you have to call it living. Okay? Subjectively, it's living. It's just like, you know that a thought adjuster is not a person. But if you get any experience with the relationship to an adjuster, there's only one word that you could possibly use to describe what you experience, and that would be love. Well, non-personal facts can't love. Love is fundamentally a personal thing. I mean, but you have no other way to describe it. I mean, that non-personal thing that you would experience if you contacted an adjuster is so transcendent of anything that any human has ever called love or ever even imagined that the word love could stand for, you know, that what else are you going to call it except love? Okay, same thing here. I mean, really, when all of a sudden, what else are you going to call this, the nature of this thing you're looking at besides living? Okay. So just, you know, they're often coming up against language. So that's what they want you to understand if you reflect on the various statements about this, is remember that this absolutum, you know, and it's not just an actuality, it's a reality. It's purposed. And up at this level again, what's the difference between spirit pattern and energy pattern? You know, personality and pattern, you know, spirit purposing and matter purposing. To the sub-absolute being, you cannot tell the difference. It seems to be exactly the same. So, see, when you experience the energy pattern, the purposing of the aisle, you're going to go, well, okay, I know this is not a person, but wow. okay. Right. See, it's going to be so amazingly incomprehensible as just a blob of dirt. it's good. Everything about it is going to seem to be the antithesis of what you know about dirt. It's absolutely perfectly purposed. It's not just a pattern. It's literally the pattern of infinity. I mean, how purposed is it? It's just, okay. So that's what's going on there with statements like that.
They're too close to the unity if they're looking at those two
next right. to each other. Right. Right, right. There's only one step after that, and there's a father, which is, you know, before the separation between between matter and spirit. So you're really close to the first source and center. All right, let's read a little more here.
It appears to us that the first source and center has concentrated all absolute potential for cosmic reality in paradise as a part of his technique of self-liberation from infinity limitations, as a means of making possible sub-infinite, even time-space, creation. But it does not follow that paradise is time-space limited just because the universe of universes discloses these qualities. Paradise exists without time and has no location in space.
See, there's that allusion to the father freeing himself from the fetters. We tied the unqualified absolute to the aisle very intimately, and we flip the unqualified around, and we have the infinite capacity. And remember, the infinite capacity is not part of the Father. That's one of the things that he separated from. See, that's kind of between the lines here. If he is also the infinite capacity, then we can't exist. The Father can't be the infinite capacity, or all you're going to have is God the infinite. You're going to have no automatons, no Chris Halversons, no nothing, except God the Infinite. And that's what's, see, they say it pretty, it means making possible sub-infinite, even time-space creation. He can't be the infinite capacity, you know, and all these things that are very intimately tied to it, like the aisle, or we can't be. There's no space for us to be if he is. Yeah, so he's got to separate himself from the aisle. But at the same time he separates from himself from the aisle, he has to be absolutely coordinated with it. Okay. But you know, it's not like, you know, part of his feet are actually are the aisle. No. I mean, there's a complete boundary there. His feet are just standing on the aisle, and he's not down inside of it. Okay? He freed himself from the fetters of unqualified infinity, and this is the center of infinity. He separated himself from it.
So it could be said that paradise has a relationship, location in relation to him.
Yeah, and yeah, you can say it both ways. Yeah, he has a look. Yeah. And then the last little thing, let's just read it, and then we'll speak to it a little.
Roughly. Space seemingly originates just below another paradise. Time just above upper paradise. Time, as you understand it, is not a feature of paradise existence, though the citizens of the central aisle are fully conscious of non-time sequence of events. Motion is not inherent on paradise, it is volitional. But the concept of distance, even absolute distance, has very much meaning as it may be applied to relative locations on paradise. Paradise is non-spatial. Hence, its areas are absolute and therefore serviceable in many ways beyond the concept of mortal mind.
Okay. So, let's just do a couple basic things out of that. Sort of the overriding philosophical points. Don't try to go scientific with it, because you know you're going to get nothing but false. Because it says, it starts out with the word roughly and then a colon. Okay? It means that you can't turn what follows into science. Don't think of it in simplistically, you know, like what have I been emphasizing? If you try to think about it simplistically, you're just going to get totally false notions. Okay. The big things that are in there are not revelations about the nature of space and time. They're trying to get you... he's trying to use the opportunity to give you a little sense of the generalization of those two experiences that you have, that you call space and time. The time part is that expression, non-time sequence of events. There is always a sequence of events. Even if you're standing on the aisle, which is absolutely transcendent of anything that you think of that you would call time. Okay? It's atemporal. But there's still a sequence of events. That's a clue that what we call time is some downstepped expression of a higher fact, a sequence of events. Okay, on paradise, now we're worshiping. Now the worshiping is over, you know, etc. There's a sequence of events. Now I'm in my dwelling place. Now I'm outside my dwelling place. I mean, there's a sequence of events.
Waiting for the next worship.
waiting for the next threefold fluctuation. But
unmanageable.
Right. But okay. See, so that's what it's just. Notice the. Again, the natural philosophy, the most general natural philosophy points before you try to do any science with a paragraph when you're dealing with the cosmology papers. You move from point A to point B volitionally because the sequence there is existential, not experiential. That'll blow your mind. Then they're saying, okay, so that's time. What about space? What about this whole distance thing? It's like, well, I mean, there's a generalization. You don't. It's not part of space as you understand it. Okay, but it doesn't mean that it's a zero volume point. There is area. Okay, I mean, you know, here's where someone lives on paradise, and here's where someone else lives. You know, here's where the deities are. I mean, you know, there's separation. There's definitely separation of things. So there's both sequence and separation, which are the higher things that give rise to space and time. Separation and a succession of events that resolves the tension of that separation, the bifurcation. Okay. That's what they're getting at. And then just, so what actually... is the nature of space and time. That's higher level stuff. But just notice the last little thing, though. Again, another thing to kind of blow your mind. So paradise is non-spatial, but, okay, it does have this separation. But it's like, what kind of things are there? Areas are absolute and therefore serviceable in many ways beyond the concept of mortal mind. Think about what that means, okay? Think about your normal notion of separation, okay? The distance between two objects, okay? These two cups, okay? And you talk about the distance between the two cups. You say, you know, it's the distance of the cup in my right hand relative to the cup in my left hand. The notion of distance is relative. This cup... relative to that cup.
Right.
Well, what if you transcend the relative?
You have absolute distance.
What does how do you even think about distance? See, that's what they're getting at. I mean, you know, you can start with something simplistic in terms of the notion of finite distance and then absolute distance, you know, and an absolute geometry. It's like, well, okay, so can I take that to the next notch? It's like, well, kind of, yeah, let's just say it. Let's have the notion of absolute distance. I mean, we have three dimensions of the finite, three dimensions of the absolute, one dimension of the absolute. Well, so maybe I could kind of think of, you know, if I have the center of infinity, that one absolute dimension is the radial distance from the center. So that's just a one-dimensional thing. How far away are you from the center? But that notion of a quote-unquote absolute distance doesn't... But what if I'm not thinking of it as a point? What if I'm thinking about it as the upper surface of the, you know, a surface area? That's what they're getting at. I mean, it's obviously going to be serviceable. I.e., the nature of this separation has a potential in it that we can't even really comprehend, because our whole notion of is just this relative separation thing, and just finite at that. We don't even have any notion of absolute separation.
Maybe it doesn't. I mean, we think of things as displacing space, and so therefore one thing can only occupy one space. Maybe space isn't displaced in that way.
Especially when it's outside of space.
So there isn't any space to displace. Wow, my head hurts. Yeah, see, that's what they want you. He's just kind of teasing you with it. It's like, you know, ruminate on that for a while, you know, and what you're gonna begin to get a sense of is what it isn't, and it's gonna leave you with, it's like, wow, what is it? Yeah, that's the point. What it actually is not comprehensible. It's trying to get you to stop thinking of the notion of paradise in some simplistic way. It's just like personality. Your first challenge is to recognize what personality isn't. It isn't anything you initially think it is. That's what personality is. The Isle of Paradise isn't anything that you initially think it is. That's what the Isle is. Okay? Yeah. And just try to let that abide within you, that absence of understanding, so that it has the appropriate remoteness that you can quest for. Okay? If you immediately dot every I and cross every T of some simplistic notion of it, then your journey to paradise has come to an end. You are no longer an ascending being.
What's next?
Okay? You know, you don't need to ascend if you've just devalued paradise down to you. It's paradise and personality and these things have to be inscrutable. You have to have the courage to let them not be known fully. Maybe you'll give yourself, well, maybe I have a vague initial inkling, but maybe not. Right? That's what you got to allow yourself to be.
Ultimately humble.
Yeah.
Absolutely
humble. Yeah, absolutely humble.
I'm wondering if the personality can have some, the true personality, course, you just qualify them, you know, can have some insight into this dimensionality.
Yes, I mean, because you're...
Absolute, because we're talking about absolutes, true personality.
But remember, you know, even that is limited.
Right.
Really, if you try to wrap your mind around the absolute dimension, the best you can hope for is a supreme notion.
Right.
See?
Right.
You know, so really, technically, experientially, it's the supreme dimension, not the absolute dimension.
Right.
Okay, but it is totally transcendent of the subtotal finite. I mean, you can take it all the way to the totality of the finite, and that's going to be your initial notion of absoluteness. The supreme being is going to be your initial notion of the absoluteness of the universal Father.
Any person who
and so just leave the closing thought as we move into our little moment of reflection, taking off of that. Is how is that relevant to my day-to-day life? do you drive a car better when you look to the horizon or when you look to the end of the hood? Okay. If you want to steer your life well, you need to be able to see beyond the end of the hood. You need to lift up and you need to look to the farthest point that you can see. And you will steer more precisely. That's the truth of this. That's why we spend the time we do trying to wrap our mind around these bigger things so that we see beyond what's immediately in front of us so that our life can be steered well. Okay, let's take a moment here.